From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers. He joins us, as usual, in studio. Tom, welcome.
Hey, happy holiday season.
Happy holiday season to you, too. Let's start with the top of the news today, and that is former Virginia Governor Robert McDonnell. The Office of U.S. Probation has recommended that he be sentenced to at least 10 years and a month in prison and 12 years and 7 months at the most. Why this is significant is because in the Commonwealth of Virginia, district judges generally follow the advice or the recommendations of the U.S. Probation Office some 70% of the time.
If this is not, you know, this is not the way to look to the new year when he gets sentenced on, what is it, January the 6th?
Yep.
You know, what's important here is that last year, he declined a plea bargain. Prosecutors came to him and said, well, you plead to this and that, we'll give you, you can agree to a three-year sentence.
Maximum. Could have gotten probation.
Yes. And so now, the public corruption, the federal U.S. attorneys have been pretty tough on public corruption when they get people into their sights. You know, Ray Nagin, the mayor of New Orleans, I think he's serving 10 years himself for taking some monies. It's just a real tough thing for the McDonald's. But you do the crime, you do the time.
Joining us in studio is Mel Franklin. He is the chair of the Prince George's County Council. He's a Democrat and a recovering attorney, right?
I am. Still recovering. good to be with both of you.
Care to share your thoughts on the possibility of former Governor McDonnell looking at 10 years?
Sure. Corruption doesn't pay. And one of the things that's very clear is that, as Tom, as you mentioned, there is a zero tolerance amongst the U.S. attorneys for public corruption, particularly where you don't own up to the actions. When they come to you and they offer you a plea or they do something like that and you say, no, I'm going to take it to trial, and you wind up losing, they, I think, are coming down particularly hard because that shows a lack of remorse and a lack of owning up to what you've done. I think people are willing to give you second chances in life if you're willing to own up to what you've done. But when you're not, particularly when you're given the public trust, and I think they come down hard on attorneys as well because we are also trusted with protecting the legal system. But yes, I think it's not a great day for those in Virginia and for the McDonald's.
And of course, you're from Prince George's County, where Jack Johnson went to prison.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. Do you happen to know? I think he went to prison in 2012. I think he's still in the slammer.
Yes. I believe until it's for another few years at least. Again, it's one of those things where you shouldn't get into elected office to make money. You should get in, that's just not the reason you should get into elective office. You should get into elective office to serve. Folks in the private sector, they're there to make money and to create wealth. But in the public sector, your job is to protect the public interest.
He got an 87-month sentence. I just looked at 87 months. I don't know how many years that is, but it's more than I would like to spend in prison.
Absolutely. 7 years,
yes,
or a little more. Governor McDonnell, like you, was term limited. In his case, one term. In your case, two terms.
Sure.
And the voters in Prince George's County in November decided to uphold term limits.
Did.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I think, and what was on the ballot would have made it three terms instead of two. So it still would have been term limits. The reasoning for it was that if you look at our neighbors in the region, very few are term limited in the district, in Montgomery County, and a lot of our neighboring jurisdictions. So their elected officials are all more experienced than we are. And that leads to certain things. For example, you're able to really secure economic development much, much better because you're able to provide that consistency long term. You're able to go after resources at the federal and state level better because you have those long term relationships. So I think it'll not be to the benefit of our residents that went down to defeat, even though it was a very narrow defeat. And it'll probably come back again at some point. But we have
it's been three times, right? It's been up three times.
Yeah, and this was the closest probably. I think this was separated by 1 point or 2 points.
We should point out that we did, in fact, have term limits in the District of Columbia, and the D.C. Council simply overrode it.
Right. And I think the district, if you see, look at a lot of the development, a lot of the progress in the district, a lot of it's due to that consistency long term. When you're doing a major development project, a lot of times it's unfolding over a 20-year period. And if you have every 8 years just over complete titanic shifts of your political arena, you're going to have a business sector that's very leery about doing business there.
The lack of term limits also gave us a mayor for life who recently passed
yes.
and who is credited with creating a significant amount of the wealth in Prince George's County.
Absolutely.
I heard your county executive at his funeral refer to Prince George's County as Ward 9, which is often referred to in the District of Columbia. But Tom Sherwood, you covered the funeral last week, and since then there has been well, speculation about who would replace the Ward 8 council member, but even more speculation about what's going to be named after him in the District of Columbia. It certainly looks as if the Summer Youth Employment Program will be so named. Mayor Gray seems to want to do that by fiat, but they're talking streets.
Well, Mayor-elect Bowser has also said she would name the Summer Jobs Program after Barry, and you couldn't have it anything else. But, you know, I think this will take some time. You know, there's a reason that things are named for people after they've passed and after consideration, because otherwise there would just be any number of things named for people. It's possible that should the city build a new government affairs building in Ward 8, once the Reeve Center at 14th and U is closed, well, then maybe that building would be it. But, you know, I just don't know. There's going to be lots of proposals. I just think there's going to have to be carefully sifted. And Mayor Gray is creating this committee, but that committee will last as long as January 2nd, 2015, when Mayor Bowser becomes mayor. And it's not clear that she'll do the same thing. But I think the mayor is trying to be, and I think Muriel Bowser will try to be respectful of Mayor Marion Barry's life.
Our guest is Mel Franklin. He is chair of the Prince George's County Council. He's a Democrat. If you have questions or comments for him, start calling now, 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. Before we get to the chairman, Tom Sherwood, one more D.C. issue. There has been a funding deal reached for D.C. United Soccer Stadium here in Washington. It authorizes up to $150 million in public spending. $150 million in public spending. Beyond
that, hell of a stadium.
Beyond that, the details are so absolutely confusing to me at this point that I leave it to you to explain.
Well, yeah, you don't have to know all the ins and outs of the details. The Mayor Gray a year ago, the short story is Mayor Gray a year ago proposed a great deal of soccer to keep D.C. United in the city. It languished in the council for almost a year. They came up with a deal to trade the Reeve Center, which I mentioned, 14th and U, as part of a big land swap.
That's not in the deal anymore.
But all that's all out. A tax break for the developer, for the team on sales taxes, that's out. If it passed 13-0, actually 12-0, when it recently, and it's going to pass again. I should point out news that's just happened. The council is going to vote. It was going to vote on December the 16th. It's now going to vote on December the 17th because Mayor-elect Bowser is going to travel to Los Angeles to be part of the team with Ted Leonsis to present the city's proposal to have the Olympics 2024. And so the soccer deal is the city will cap its expenses at $150 million for the land. There will be some other additional charges, but not much. The team is responsible for building the stadium for about $150 million. My fear is the team will get it about halfway built and say, oh, we need some more money. Then what will the city do?
Participate in some more Hollywood.
But the main thing is for
accounting.
The city. You know, Jack Evans, the council member, he wants all the pro teams to play in the District of Columbia, and that includes pardon me, Mr. Franklin, getting the football team back in town, too,
well,
we'll get to in just a moment.
Mr. Franklin and his people are likely to oppose that.
Yes, we
you
are.
Were elected to another term as chairman of the council. Congratulations. But things
Thank
are going
you.
To be a little bit different this time around.
Right.
There's going to be a Republican running the show in Annapolis come January.
Sure.
What are your priorities for the Prince George's County Council this term, and how do you expect different leadership in Annapolis is going to affect those plans?
Great question. So we are on the county council, and I think the county executive would also agree, focused on bringing the world to Prince George's County, as we like to say. We are transforming our jurisdiction from really what has been for decades a bedroom community into much more of an economic destination. So you see what's happening in National Harbor. You see what's happening. We're building a new regional medical center at Largo, the State Department of Housing in New Carrollton. We're doing a lot of great things in terms of Westphalia, Conterra. These are all big projects. Over $5 billion in development is on its way to Prince George's County in the next several years.
What about the people who moved there because it was a bedroom community?
Well, I think a lot of those folks, I hear from a lot of them, they actually want a lot more amenities. They are, so they moved to the county and they like the way the county has been, but they're ready for the county to change because they're tired of traveling to the district or Virginia or other parts of Maryland for a great meal or for great shopping or for things like that or to work. I mean, when you look at how bad the traffic has gotten over the last decade, I mean, it's just mind-boggling. And so people really want to foster the kind of destination so that they'll be able to work and eat and play right in Prince George's County.
You want economic development similar to Tyson's Corner or Bethesda.
Absolutely.
Or these other places where people can live, work, and play.
Absolutely. And then we want to cultivate our very underdeveloped metro stations. We have 15 of them in the county. We're starting to invest in those. The Regional Medical Center would actually transform the Largo station and create a downtown area there where we'll cultivate that. So that's a big priority for the county, continuing that forward. Next, we've got to do something, obviously, about our public schools. I think we have a great new school CEO, Dr. Kevin Maxwell. What we have to do there is to kind of be bold and innovative in how we invest in the school system. To, one, attract residents back to the system. We have a lot of residents who opt for private school. That hurts our school system.
Do you have charter schools?
We do. And those are part of the public system. So to attract those residents back to the system and for residents who don't live in the county, to encourage them to live in the county, we have to be focused on creating the kind of programs within the system that are going to be attractive to those residents.
Well, Prince George's County has one of the wealthiest African-American populations in the country.
Absolutely. Right? The wealthiest.
It is the wealthiest. I never say things like that
wrong.
But you also have within the beltway parts of Prince George's County, you have issues with crime. And I know that the city is, not jokingly, but it said we're pushing a lot of the poor people to Prince George's County. The district is getting to be so expensive now with houses in Ward 8 and Ward 7. Prices are going up. A lot of people are moving to Prince George's County. What about public safety as an issue, just as an image, not even as a reality, but as an image?
So one of the great stories about the county is the dramatic, historic drops in crime. We're going to reduce homicides once again this year by a significant amount. From 2000, if you remember back in 2005 when you were hearing about homicides every other day in Prince George's County, now they're a rarity. Now when you hear about them, it's a surprise to hear about them because they're happening so infrequently.
So what do you attribute that?
We've invested a lot in public safety over the last 4 years. And really, even beyond the last 4 years, there's been a lot of investments in growing our police force, growing our sheriff's office, been a lot invested in preventative measures. The county executives probably talked to you all about the Transforming Neighborhoods Initiative, where they focus on a lot of indicators that contribute to crime and getting out in front and kind of the wraparound approach. All of that's come together, in my opinion, to help reduce crime more dramatically than other places have seen in the region. That, I think, is getting the business community to take a really strong look at the county.
Transportation. What do you see at stake now that the fate of the Purple Line is more uncertain with Larry Hogan going into the governor's mansion?
So transportation, I think, is one of these issues that we're going to really have to focus on as a business issue. Our lack of infrastructure in Maryland, and it's not just a Maryland problem, but over on our side in Maryland is it threatens the future of our business community and growing economically. And I think the governor-elect has focused a lot on the business climate in Maryland. The Purple Line is a strong component of promoting business for the state of Maryland, not just in assisting with congestion on that corridor, but also providing new opportunities for business to create hubs of economic development in Prince George's and Montgomery County. So I think he'll see the business case for the Purple Line.
Have you had any conversations with him yet about that?
I personally have not. I know the county executive has. And I do intend to very soon have those conversations with him if his schedule permits.
800-433-8850 is our number. Mel Franklin is our guest. He is chair of the Prince George's County Council. Here's Tom Sherwood.
Mollette Green, who's a reporter for Channel 4, was saying to me, well, what is Hogan's concern? Is that he's coming in to be the governor, Republican sure. governor, generally you would think pro-business.
Sure.
You're pitching the Purple Line as pro-business.
Sure.
I'm sure those two are connected.
Right.
But what is his objection, that it's just too much money for too little purpose? I mean,
well, during the campaign, right. there were some objections about just the cost of devoting that much of our transportation right. budget to that project. But the unique thing about the Purple Line is it involves so much other investment. Just in my understanding is Congress in the budget piece that they just passed contains $100 million for the Purple Line. So, you know, we're getting revenue from other sources to combine with our state funding, in addition to the private sector funding. It's a P3 public-private partnership project. So the Purple Line is going to be unique in that it's going to bring all of these sources of revenue from elsewhere to help sustain some of the costs. So I understand his concern, but on the Purple Line, I think we've done a good job of going out and finding other sources of revenue for it as well.
On transportation, because I do think transportation, crime, jobs, all those things are
interconnected. Absolutely.
In National Harbor, access to National Harbor, it's if you want to go by car, you can be there in a jackrabbit,
sure.
right? You just
sure.
right down over the Wilson Bridge or right down 295 from any other place in the county. But it's but for people who come there, I've heard people, my sister came for a convention there.
Mm-hmm.
She liked National Harbor.
Right.
But she said she felt trapped
sure.
at National Harbor. She couldn't get, she wanted to come to the, she thought she was coming to Washington.
Sure.
And I said, no, you're not quite in Washington.
She's coming to National
right.
Harbor.
To
right.
National Harbor. And you couldn't get to the mall and all the things we have in Washington. How is that going to be I mean, once you get the convention, I mean, the casino
yeah,
built there,
right.
that's going to, you know, how casinos, they love to get you inside the building and not let you go
sure.
till you're out of money and eating all their food.
Right.
So I'm just wondering what kind of transportation network is going to, public transportation network, is going to serve National Harbor.
And really, this is just a function of money. I mean, we're, I think, on the Prince George's side, we're very supportive of rail across the Wilson Bridge, also transportation from the district. And so we're supportive of both of those options, as well as we're encouraging Maryland to support funding, bringing transportation down from Branch Avenue so that you have a connection from the metro system from a few different angles. But more immediately, it'd be great to have a funding plan put together, multi-jurisdictional, that supported bringing it from the district across the Wilson Bridge to National Harbor so that we can have those opportunities for tourism to go and take advantage of the other parts of the region. But it's really just a function of money. It's a function of figuring out a funding source for that. Right now, that funding source doesn't exist. But we're going to have to be creative because, again, we're outgrowing our infrastructure. And that's true even down at National Harbor. So it makes business sense. I know people don't like taxes. I know. But if we can really focus on what we would be investing in, I think you can sell that to the voters.
And we know that the MGM casino will bring a lot of people there.
Absolutely.
But how are you going to make sure that this development, well, does right by Prince George's County?
Well, one of the things we focused a great deal of time and attention on was requiring a community benefits agreement with MGM before we authorized them moving ahead with building.
And what would those benefits be?
So there are a lot of them, but they focus on some key areas. One is in the construction phase, local minority business, local business participation.
And what if it doesn't happen?
So
what if they simply don't do that? What would be the penalties?
So,
because the problem we've had here in the district
sure.
is not putting these measures in place.
Mm.
It's enforcing them.
Absolutely. So we have financial penalties, significant ones built into the agreement. We have an entire oversight entity that we've appointed that's going to monitor. So they'll be reporting throughout the construction phase. And then once they've been operating, they'll continue to report on their progress. We have requirements on hiring. So it's not just the contractors. It's also actually the jobs themselves in the construction and operating phase in terms of local residents getting those work hours. So
are the penalties built in if they don't meet them, or are they just subject to unspecified penalties?
So the penalties are actually stated in the agreement, but they're contingent on them. If, you know, if we don't have capacity in an area, for example, they have to go through a pretty rigorous analysis of justifying that we don't have the business capacity. So, for example, let's say it was concrete or something like that. If we don't have enough companies that do that in the county and they can demonstrate that, then they can get some relief from the requirement on that particular category.
And what do you get? What does the county get? State sales tax go to the state. What are the taxes, and are there county fees or restaurant fees, or where are you going to make money off the casino?
Sure. We get the property tax benefit, okay, which is significant, and then we also get amusement taxes. We also get the VLT taxes. Slots. The slots.
Okay.
Well,
speak English here.
I'm sorry, yes.
Kojo Show. Slots.
Right. There's a component of the revenue that's generated from the slots that goes to the county.
Did you have an estimate about how much money per year you'll take in taxes?
Yeah, it ranges.
You know, Baltimore's not doing as well as they thought, and maybe you guys are going to take business from Maryland Live, or Maryland Live will keep getting business from you in Anne Arundel.
Sure.
Is it going to be the cash cow that you ever hoped it is?
I think it is, one, because we're building a far grander, and in all due respect to my friends in Baltimore, we're building a far grander facility, resort, I should say, at MGM National Harbor than either Maryland Live or the Horseshoe in Baltimore City.
So
we're building really an international destination, and the location is incredible, being right next to the District of Columbia.
And more importantly, Virginia. You have all those repressed gamblers. There's never going to be a casino in Virginia.
Right.
You get them all.
Right. So the location is one of the best locations in the world.
What if the district puts a casino in the city, though?
Well,
we get 20-something million visitors a year. Sharon Pratt Kelly, back in the early 90s, had suggested the old convention center be turned into a casino similar to one that's in London,
sure,
an upscale casino. And, of course, people went crazy against that idea.
Yeah, I think you all are running out of space in the district.
No, we have plenty of room.
I think with the D.C. United, that's going to take up the last bit of space.
If the Purple Line is one open question, another one is the selection of new headquarters for the FBI. How do you think an incoming Republican Congress, both houses, will affect that equation for Prince George's as it continues to lobby for the FBI to come there?
Sure. I think, you know, one, you have the issue on the merits of where the FBI should go, and then you have the political.
There's only, what, one Republican in the entire county, maybe?
No. If that. He or she may have left.
A development deal is going to be based on the merits? That's breaking news.
It's a combination. I think on the merits, we have the best locations. I think you have, whether it's Greenbelt, which is right next to the metro station, Landover, which is a great undeveloped site close to the district itself. We think we have the best locations. We put together the best plan. The entire Maryland delegation is all on board. The political ramifications of the Republican Congress are going to be complicated. Obviously, the House was already Republican, so that won't really be a change. It's really a change on the Senate side. I still think Senator Mikulski will have a great deal of clout, even not being the chair of the committee anymore.
But we now committee.
Well, yeah, right. Now we have a Republican governor on the Maryland side, though, so maybe that'll play into the advantage with a Republican Congress.
I've never heard the FBI hierarchy. I've heard some lower-level officials in the FBI world say they want to go to Virginia. They felt like with Barbara Mikulski as appropriations chairman, she had the most power to wheel and deal to make sure they go to Maryland, Prince George's County specifically. But they thought that with the November 4th election, that loosens up the politics of it, and that Virginia has a better chance now. Do you have any sense of that's true?
You know, I think some of that gets a little exaggerated. I do think that on the Virginia side, the Springfield site, while it's it's got some advantages, it's going to be a tough site, I think, to get the FBI to come to because of the on-site issues with the CIA facilities that are already there, and the proximity of the metro is much further away than the Greenbelt location in Prince George's, for example. So I think it offers for the FBI some challenges in terms of convenience that and development that we don't have an issue with on the Maryland side.
Can we just very quickly say, we talk about this because it's 11,000 jobs and all the ancillary jobs that would be created to serve and feed those folks.
Sure.
It's a big deal.
And it's a $2 billion development. I mean, it's not insignificant.
Put on your headphones, please, because Yvette in Bowie, Maryland, has indicating that she's been wanting to talk to you for a long time.
Great.
Yvette, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Mel. This is Yvette Jardine.
Hi,
we've worked
Yvette.
Together on a number of issues before, particularly when it came to Camp Springs.
Great to hear your voice.
But I have a question. I go to see a massage therapist, and she's been having some issues with gentlemen coming to her place of business looking for massages. I think you know where I'm going with this.
Are they really looking for massages?
Well, I think she explained it pretty well.
I'm sorry.
I don't think we need to ask her to go any further.
Details, please.
We understand.
Go ahead, please.
Exactly.
Right.
And she has called your office on a couple of occasions. It's in Upper Marlboro, and I'm not sure if it's actually in your district, but I directed her to your office because as the council chair, and that you are very responsive. You have served my county very well. I'm so proud of you.
Sure.
But she's been dealing with one of your staff, and she's gotten absolutely nowhere. And this has been going on for 2 years.
So you decided to take this opportunity when he is on the air to make a public request for him to address this issue of the unwanted massage requests.
This issue one of just law enforcement. She needs some help from the police department in discouraging men from making these unwanted requests?
No, the issue is that it's illegal. It's not her business that they're looking for. They're looking for another one that is in the place in the suite of where she's located. And the issue is that it is illegal, and she has been trying to get some assistance. She's called the police department and had no luck. She's called your office and has had no luck.
Well, Chairman Franklin has been duly informed.
Absolutely. I'll definitely personally look into it. Some of it will depend on exactly what she's asking to be done. It sounds like maybe this is an entity without a valid UNO. Is that
what's her? What's a UNO?
I'm sorry, use and occupancy permit. I'm sorry. I get into when it starts.
I thought UNO sounded like a pizza joint.
or a United Nations group.
When we start talking constituent services, I start going into the lingo.
Okay. Well, could she just put up a sign saying, I'm sorry, what you're looking for is down the hall?
No, what's down the hall may not be legal.
Right. Sounds
well,
like
but
that's
at least
the issue.
Get them out of your place.
So I'll personally, Yvette, thank you for bringing that up. I'll personally look into that.
But, that kind of constituent call is kind of what local government really is all about.
Absolutely. Every day.
Those
are
the things. The stop signs, the traffic lights, the garbage containers, the bad businesses that are ruining my business next door.
Absolutely.
That's really the nitty-gritty of elected life.
And Go ahead, please.
Yeah. No, the issues are very complicated. So depending on the particular aspect of the problem, it can be resolved quickly or it may take a long time, particularly if the business has a strategy of sort of legal maneuvering. And we've run into that where some businesses are lawyered up and they are legally maneuvering the law to their advantage.
I just got...
Go ahead, please.
I only have a
minute left.
Okay, I just got a tweet from someone who says... referring to you, I think, not me or Kojo. Mm-hmm. Who is he kidding? National Harbor as a national destination for MGM. You're trapped. It's a pricey tourist trap. I've heard tourist trap before. Because you get there, you can't move around.
Well, look, I mean, at the end of the day, we do want people to spend money there. You have some great restaurants, great hotels. You're going to have you have now some great shopping with the Tanger Outlet. So absolutely, we want people to stay there, spend money, but we also want them to have access to other parts of the region. So I definitely agree that we need to work on a funding strategy for the transportation.
And you're going to be running for chairman of the county in 2018?
You can run again in 2018?
And for chairman?
When No. So
I'm talking about chairman. The county executive.
That's what I'm talking about. Because you're term limited on the council. Oh, you're out in 2018.
I am out in 2018.
There's only one other job you can run for in 2018.
County executive.
County executive. Are you prepared to announce now?
Not prepared to announce now.
You're looking at it.
It's definitely
I'll answer for him. I'll answer for him. Yeah, there you go. Under consideration.
That's you certainly dressed like a county executive already.
He could run for Congress. He could do that. He could run, or Sharon Baker might run for governor. There's all kinds of things happening.
No, he's running for county executive. That's what the word is. Unless he changes that. Mel Franklin is the chair of the Prince George's County Council. He's a Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
As county executive, you'd be at the Grand Opening of the MGM?
Never end.
Would you be the MGM? When's the MGM going to open?
It will open the latter part of 2016.
I'll still be a council member. Okay, you'll be in the back row of speakers. Okay.
Mr. Franklin, Chairman Franklin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Up next is D.C. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton and Adam Eidinger, chair of the D.C. Cannabis Campaign. You can start calling for them now, 800-433-8850. In the meantime, Tom Sherwood, there was a plan afoot to shut down at least a mile of 395 for a construction project that is taking place here at the entrance of I-395. And apparently the idea of shutting it down was first reported by NBC4's Adam Tuss, correct?
Adam Tuss did that. That was the first story I actually did when I went to work for Channel 4 25 years ago. Was I stood there at the tunnel area there and said, developers want to deck this over and build there. Well, now it's really happening. But the developer said, look, we can have this thing partially shut down for years and years and years, or why don't we just close it for, 18 months or something like that. And then we'll just do it really quickly, then we'll reopen it. The mayor was horrified. Muriel Bowser said that she wouldn't study it, that she was against it, and so it just dropped right there. I think 90,000
members of congressional delegations from Virginia were also not very pleased about it.
Well, you know what? Those congressional delegations from Virginia, they should focus on their. But I don't want to get started on that yet, but I'm all just wired up for them.
Yes.
But in any event, if we could keep them from out of the tunnel, maybe I would close it for but let's move on.
Yes, indeed. Let's move on, because there's one other quick issue, and that is the city administrator in a Bowser administration is going to be Rashad Young, currently city administrator of Alexandria, Virginia. He's moving to a much larger jurisdiction, but what's wrong with that?
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. Our city has 10 times the number of city employees, and our budget, the Alexandria budget, is like $640 million. The district budget's close to $12 billion. But I talked to Mayor Yule from Alexandria about him this week, and he says the guy learns quickly, is agreeable with folks. So when Bowser introduced him at one of the salt domes here in town, I asked him what his management style was. I said, do you rant and rave in private and throw things, and then you're nice in public? He says he's basically calm in public and private. Well, this job will test to see whether he's up to it. We'll know in 6 months, someone said.
Indeed it will. Joining us in studio now is Adam Eidinger. He is the chair of the D.C. Cannabis Campaign, the group that organized a referendum for the legalization of marijuana in the district this past election. Adam, good to see you again. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me in.
And joining us by phone is Eleanor Holmes Norton. She is a member of the United States House of Representatives, a Democrat. She represents the District of Columbia. Congresswoman Norton, thank you for joining us.
Of course, Koja.
I'd like you first both to listen to what New Jersey Senator Democrat Cory Booker had to say about the bill that was passed by the House, the funding bill that would negate the vote on the marijuana initiative in the District of Columbia. Here is Senator Cory Booker.
You see, it's because the very idea of taxation without representation and the self-determination of peoples is at the core of our democratic ideals as a nation. Yet despite this, Washington, D.C., with a population larger than two of our states, sees the constant undermining of this very principle. I believe it is an offense to Americans of all states and Americans in the District of Columbia and all those who believe in our cherished ideals that this is done so. And so when the District of Columbia votes, just like Colorado, just like Washington, just like Oregon, just like Alaska, to change marijuana laws, when Washington, D.C. grapples with the devastating impact of the drug war, sees the pain and the challenges and the struggles involved therein, when the people of the city come together and decide to try a different way forward, should we not honor their results? Should we not respect their self-determination, as is going on in other states? This provision in this omnibus undermining the democratic will of the District of Columbia, of these great Americans, should be taken out.
Well, Congresswoman Norton, Senator Cory Booker says the provision should be taken out. It made it through the House. What are the prospects in the Senate?
Well, first let me say I couldn't have said it better myself than Cory said it. And I think he probably stepped forward because he was mayor of a big city of Newark and had some understanding of why our own District of Columbia residents would have taken the position that they took. Now, at this point, I certainly can't say to you that the Senate, which helped negotiate the final bill, will take it completely out. That's why I've looked very closely at the language to see if there is an alternative interpretation that can allow the referendum to go forward.
Well, Ms. Norton, before we get to that part of what we might do, because I do think that's important, what is the city going to do as opposed to just complain? Did you at any point call up or speak directly to Barbara Mikulski, the chairman of the Appropriations Senate Committee, and tell her to take this language out? This is not part of the federal budget negotiation. Take this language out. Did you ever speak directly to Barbara Mikulski? And why didn't she do it? If she likes the city, why didn't she do it?
Well, first of all, I spoke not only with Senator Mikulski, but with all of the leaders. Now, when I tell you what happened with the language and the alternative that is possible for the city to go forward, it will be quite possible to believe that the Democrats did, in fact, help us out. So I don't think you should be so quick to assume that did not occur.
Well, you've got some shadow campaign behind the scene to have a different kind of language. That's one thing. But to me, it was the language says you cannot enact any legislation.
I ask you not to become a lawyer here.
I'm not becoming a lawyer, but
I'm going to law school.
I'm just looking for a little bloody outrage.
Well, the outrage, let us understand what the outrage is about. Even if the alternative interpretation that I believe is quite possible for the city to use, and my point was to give them the opportunity to decide which interpretation to use, there should still be outrage.
The Congress...
The outrage would come from the fact that the city cannot do anything further, and it probably intended to do something further with marijuana law, and in no case should the district be preempted from doing whatever it wants to do in any law.
Congresswoman Norton, for our listeners who don't understand what we're talking about here, what you seem to be saying, and explain if I'm correct, is that the bill as passed would prevent the city from taxing and regulating marijuana. It will not overturn the initiative technically or legally so that marijuana could still be legal in the District of Columbia.
That's right. And what the voters approved was only the possession of small amounts of marijuana and its cultivation. It never approved the commercialization of marijuana, though we have seen considerable interest in that. And I must say that the four other states, within their own referendum language, did have commercialization. We did not. That may have been for technical reasons, but it does show you that others are going ahead with that, and the district is being kept from that by the Congress of the United States.
Well, before bringing Adam in, the Congress castrated democracy in the nation's capital.
Once again,
I must say that the leadership, I don't think you have to go lie down in the streets of Congress or whatever to do something like that, but I'm quite stunned by the kind of business as usual reaction from Mayor Gray and from Mayor-elect Bowser. It just seems business as usual. I'm not sure. I mean, I've asked people, what should we do? Should we stop serving the Congress and stop cleaning the streets? Should we stop giving the president police protection from our police officers who can't have their own democracy in this city? I mean, it seems to me it's just business as usual response. And you're hoping to work the language.
You're also proposing a set of things that they could not do.
But
so, I mean, if you want to talk about what they could do, it seems to me that you've got to give certainly the new mayor time to consider how to approach what will surely be, and let me go on record as saying this, if you think this is bad, wait until you see what a Republican House and a Republican Senate can do, and let's see what you come up with for that.
Well, Adam Eidinger, you organized the campaign to put this measure on the ballot in November. You rallied support to get it passed. You climbed the hill to convince members of Congress not to mess with it. They did. Now what?
Well, I have to say I'm coming around to Congresswoman Norton's position here, that, in fact, there was a deal made to save the will of the voters. I can't sit here and tell you they overturned our initiative. They didn't do that. They are preventing us from passing future legislation such as tax and regulate, which is another way of saying stores that sell marijuana. But if you want to put this in perspective, how far we've come, I mean, we're having a debate about DC democracy and marijuana legalization on the floor of Congress. There are multiple members of Congress that have come forward and spoke in favor of this language, saying that actually it protects the will of the voters. To me, that was the criteria for me not moving to Andy Harris's district and working on challenging him in the next election as a candidate, is that I've threatened to move there, and I'm not going to have to move there because we will be able to grow marijuana in our homes later next year. The only thing that could really stop this would be a standalone bill next year by the new Congress. And that bill could be passed in the House, in theory. I could see it happening, just the climate there is awful. But in the Senate, there are senators on both sides of the aisle that have said that they don't think they should be messing with D.C. And the only reason they're messing with D.C. now is because they were able to slip it into a bill that had to be passed to keep the government open. And, you know, we don't have enough leverage up there to prevent this from getting in, apparently. But we gave it a hell of a fight this week. And I'm now of the perspective that we are going to be giving away seeds to people in the city. Less than an ounce of marijuana seeds will be legal to possess and to share, as long as you don't give it away, as long as you don't charge for it.
This conversation alone, Congresswoman Norton, underscores what happens when Congress finds out that the District of Columbia is doing things that some members, and it looks like soon a majority in both houses, may not want it to do. Is it likely that based on what we're saying here right now, we're likely to see a measure that simply says, no, what we intended was that this initiative should not take hold. You cannot possess marijuana legally in the District of Columbia.
Yeah, but unlike what my friend Tom was saying, we're not going to give up now by adopting the Republican interpretation of the bill. If there is an alternative interpretation, then it seems to me we should insist upon it, and then make them work for it. On their watch, when they get control.
May I ask this question? And I don't want to get too bogged down in procedures. The measure that was passed by the people, the Congress has not. I mean, the Council has not yet transmitted it to the Congress. It will, Mr. The chairman, Mendelson, said he would do that after the first of the year because it would start a new congressional session. Well, it seems to me, if this measure passes the Congress and the president signs it, the big $1 trillion budget bill, it says you can't do anything. So
No.
It says you cannot enact. Could I respond?
Well, sure. But just so I know, someone was in the mayor's office and in the council was saying if the ban is you cannot enact, then that means that sending the measure to the Hill is part of the enactment.
It is not part of the enactment. Can I respond?
Well, now you can. Now that you shouted me down.
To Congress and approval by Congress, according to the Home Rule Act, are not enactment, but constitute when the law becomes effective. The Home Rule Act uses the word effective. So, again, Tom, don't be so quick to rush to the Republican interpretation. Look, we have looked at the laws. We've looked at the Home Rule Act. We've looked at this law. Maybe we're wrong, but guess what? If we're wrong, then we ought to make the Republicans do the hard work of overturning this law and not concede it while the Democrats are in power.
I hope you're right, but this reminds me of the council trying to go around the Congress on the budget matter and didn't go anywhere.
Well, in this case, I must
say, I'm not saying it's the same thing, but it's the same genre.
It's not even close to the same thing, because I'm going to cite language. The language of the Harris, the so-called original language, had that none of the funds should be used to enact or carry out. They took carry out out. Somebody very cleverly took carry out out. There is nothing in the marijuana legalization referendum that needs to be carried out. It is self-contained. It needs no rules or regulations.
And you're pretty sure that language is not going to be stuck back in the Senate?
If it is, I would be very surprised.
Okay.
Because the way in which we think it's going to happen now, since the Democrats have gone back home, frankly, the House has gone back home, is that the Senate has been pretty much given a take-it-or-leave a deal. I wish we could have gotten some changes in the Senate and in the House. But you can't, if you represent the district, say, I must depend on them doing what I want them to do. You've got to look closely at what they do. And in their rush to do it, I believe they have made a mistake.
Adam, you were at Majority Leader Harry Reid's office on Wednesday, and you weren't able to get FaceTime with him. What did his staff say, and what explanation did other Democrats offer to you for the route they're taking?
Well, George Holman said that he voted for the initiative, and he's a longtime district resident now, and he's outraged by what's happening. But they don't want to shut the government down. And the president is saying the same thing. They don't want to shut the government down. They really feel that they're going to suffer politically if the government gets shut down. And there are a lot of Republicans that want to shut the government down against Boehner's wishes. So I just want to get back to if this amendment, if they had passed the budget on time before the election, we would be screwed right now. Okay, am I right, Congresswoman?
Yes, you are.
Okay, because then we'd be enacting. But here is Jeff in Bethesda, Maryland. Jeff, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. I don't know. I guess I'm a very simple man. I don't understand why we can't just immediately start impeachment processes for any government official that blatantly goes against the will of the people. They all took an oath to represent the people of their particular districts, and when they go directly against the will of the people, they are not representing us. They are representing whomever is in charge.
I did a little investigation,
and it seems that Congressman Harris's entire opposition to this is the almost $500,000 he received from Big Pharma.
I won't let Tom Sherwood tell you about the D.C. Council overturning the people's decision on term
but
limits.
But also, the Congress, I'm sorry to say, the Constitution allows Congress full legislative authority over the district. So if it wants to put a Ferris wheel on the mall, it can.
And Eleanor Holmes Norton is the law professor here. What do you say?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. And besides, we'd have to impeach all the Republicans in the House and Senate.
What do you want the citizens, both of you, Mr. Eidinger and the Congresswoman, what do you want the citizens to do rather than stand by passively and see what the government leaders do? What do you want to happen to raise the temperature?
Oh, I want to answer this one. First of all, right now, people are going to the Senate and they're sitting in the gallery. Yesterday, a woman just took a D.C. flag out of her coat pocket and held it out, and she was immediately ushered out of the Senate. But when those things happen, it sends a message that we're watching. And, you know, some people in the past have stood up in the Senate gallery and the House gallery and have said D.C. votes no when there have been egregious riders on moving legislation about our local laws. So I encourage that type of activity. I was about to do it yesterday, but I just didn't want to interrupt a discussion about the pension plan that's in this bill. And, you know, there are things in the omnibus that are getting done. And I have to acknowledge, as a marijuana activist, this is an amazing bill for medical marijuana at the national level, and it basically sets up a scenario where the president, I think, now has the authorization that he needs to reschedule marijuana, take it out of Schedule 1. And when that happens, I think the Harris Amendment also gets thrown out because it only deals with Schedule 1 substances. I think we're moving so far forward on this right now, and we've gotten used to winning a lot, and now I just have to sort of take this as a victory. It's a sour kind of victory, and I know I'm talking to lawyers a lot.
I want to say that to Adam, we've had things put on our appropriation before. We seldom see D.C. residents do what you have done and what D.C. vote has done. We do need to see more activism. I can't be up there talking, and It looks like their D.C. residents don't care about something. And they may not be able to turn it around by coming to the House and coming to the Senate and demonstrating, but they are showing that we are not going to take this anymore.
Yeah, well, can the city stop picking up the trash? Or who picks up the trash? I just think there ought to be some dramatic thing to occur other than the arrest thing, which has already been done, and the marches and all that. It just seems to me there ought to be some kind of response from the people who have just been castrated.
You may have to quit your job and lead that yourself.
Well, I'm just talking as a journalist opinion person, and my column will be addressing this.
Here is Phone Homie in Washington, D.C. Phone Homie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. I just want to thank everybody on the panel for even bringing this subject up for a discussion. And I want to also extend my thank yous to Adam Eidinger and all his staff for tirelessly helping out to help us get this legalization passed. We've got all of D.C. marijuana activists on the edge of their seat trying to figure out what's going on here. And a lot of us are, indeed outraged that, our vote doesn't seem to stand for much right now, as it seems. But I guess really my question is, as a resident, as a citizen, and just to really reiterate what we can do, my question is, what can we do out there? What can we do as citizens, as activists, as people who want to see our vote?
Adam, you've been the one doing this, and D.C. vote and others.
Well, I have been speaking to some local artists about erecting a democracy statue next year near the Capitol and setting up a 24-hour-a-day encampment for D.C. democracy. We're going to have to defend this against the new Congress. I kind of want to set the tone right off the bat, so I think they come into work on the 4th or 5th of January. Around that time, I think we'll have our act together about what we're going to do.
We're running out of time very quickly. Does the D.C. Attorney General have a role? Have you had conversations with Carl Racine? He's the D.C. Attorney General elect. Right. He's essentially the lawyer for the city.
The city attorneys are looking at this, and I do want to say, Adam, I think briefly mentioned that people of authority in the House, Nancy Pelosi, the ranking members of the Appropriation Committee, have all endorsed the interpretation that Adam and I believe the city can apply.
And it seems that Mary-elect Muriel Bowser has also, she says that she is not opposed to going forward with an unregulated environment.
Wow. So, it's time to declare victory until they defeat us.
Yeah, and
D.C. Appleseed has now put out a release saying that
it is regulated.
Eleanor Holmes Norton is a member of the United States House of Representatives. She's a Democrat who represents the District of Columbia. Thank you so much for joining us. Adam Eidinger is chair of the D.C. Cannabis Campaign, the group that organized a referendum for the legalization of marijuana in the district this past election. Thank you for joining us, Adam. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the Current Newspapers. Go forth and organize.
I didn't finish my rant.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up Monday on the Kojo Nandi show, 2 jobs, no credit, no car. An accidental ambassador for the poor gives a first-hand account of life without a safety net. Then at 1, from opera stars to pop princesses, everyone's got a take on holiday tunes. Composer Rob Capello explores what makes a new classic. The Kojo Nandi show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.